Okay, so I think we can start this evening's talk. I'm going to talk today about impermanence, a very large area, very large part of the Buddhist teaching is about impermanence, but it's also a very profound, a very important part of Buddhism, because impermanence in many ways is almost like a foundational view of how we look at the universe as Buddhists. If we understand impermanence, almost everything else comes from the understanding of impermanence. So this impermanence is what we call reality as it actually is, according to Buddhism. So if we understand impermanence in ourselves, if we're able to see impermanence in the world, then we are seeing reality as it actually is. In Buddhism, we talk about very often about three qualities of reality, three characteristics of reality. And these three characteristics are impermanence, suffering, and non-self. And of these three, the most basic one is the idea of impermanence. That comes first. And from the idea of impermanence follows the two other characteristics. And the reason for this is simply that suffering, you can understand suffering to a certain extent, just by watching your own life, watching your own body, watching your own mind, you will see the suffering to a large extent. But to fully comprehend suffering, the only way you can do that is to also, at the same time, fully understand impermanence. Once you understand impermanence, then only then does suffering become absolutely clear. And the same is true for non-self. Non-self can only be understood fully, 100%, in the context of impermanence. It's when everything is seen as impermanent, that is when you understand the idea of non-self. So the foundation, in a sense, the thing which is the most direct experience that we can have of this reality of things as it actually is the experienced understanding of impermanence. And sometimes you may think that this idea of impermanence is very obvious, because you look around in the world and you can see, yeah, sure, things are impermanent. It's quite, on a certain level, it's very easy to see that things are impermanent in the world. Everything changes, everything goes from one state to another. Sometimes things disappear altogether, so they're, in a sense, absolutely, fully impermanent. But it is the scope of that impermanence, the breadth of it, and the depth of it, which is so astounding, and which is so hard to actually grasp, because quite literally, everything, anything you can experience, anything you can ever see, is impermanent. Absolutely everything. And that is what is so so remarkable about it. And that is what is so hard to understand, that everything is impermanent. And the other thing is that is the depth of this impermanence, is the subtlety of it, and to fully understand it is actually very difficult, because it involves aspects of the mind, for example, which are so deep and so profound, things that we have looked upon as permanent for lifetimes, for eons, forever, basically. And these things, these subtle, very refined things inside of us, also turn out to be impermanent. Very hard to see these things. And it takes profound insight, profound meditation practice, to actually see these kind of depths in the mind. So don't take too easily, don't think that, yes, I understand impermanence, because on the one level it is easy to observe, but to fully understand it is actually quite difficult. And for this reason, it is very useful to actually contemplate impermanence. The more you contemplate it, the more you make it real, the more you actually align your view of the world with the way the world actually is. If you don't align your view of the world with the way the world actually is, it means that you're going to act stupidly. You're going to act in ways which are contrary to the way the world is. The more you actually see the world in the way the world is, the more you can act with wisdom, with understanding, and then you can be wise, then you can be kind, then you can do all the right things in a proper and kind way. So this is very important, to see the world as it actually is. So that is why the simple contemplation of impermanence, reminding yourself that things in daily life, whatever they are impermanent, is often enough to change your view slightly, change the way you look at the world slightly, sufficiently for you to be wiser, to be more skillful, to be kinder, to do all these things that we try to do in Buddhism, to live a more spiritual and more happy life. So, I want to talk about two things in particular. First of all, I want to talk about a little bit of the scope of this thing we call impermanence. Where does it actually reach? Maybe talk about some areas you haven't contemplated before, where this impermanence goes. That is the first part. And as the last part, I want to give a couple of practical examples on how we can actually reflect on impermanence to make it part of our spiritual practice, to make us better as human beings. So the first aspect of impermanence, and the first thing which is very easy to see that is impermanent, is all the material, all the physical world around us. It is very clear that this physical world around us is impermanent on all levels, on everything here. Starting from the very smallest things in life, the very smallest things which are discoverable by science, the atoms, all the way down, all the way up to the universe as its largest extent. All of this is impermanent. And everything in between that you can see in between there, from your cherished belongings to all your friends, your family, your own body, these are all the physical, material things of the world, to everything inside, the cities, the deserts, the oceans, the planet, the trees, whatever is in here, everything, absolutely everything is impermanent. And it is impermanent in two ways. It is impermanent in the sense that it is constant change. Things are changing all the time. You see your body getting older. You see the trees falling over when there's a storm. You see the earth constantly changing. You see climate change happening. Change is happening continuously. But there's also another way in which there is impermanence, a more profound way. And that is in the sense that things cease, they come to an end completely. And we know, for example, that according to modern science, the earth itself is eventually going to be swallowed up completely by the sun and will disappear in this great blaze a few billion years from now. So impermanence is all pervasive in the material world. And of course, that has enormous consequences for us because a lot of our attachments, a lot of things that we hold on to in the world are precisely in that material world. That's why we find so much of our delight. We delight in these things in this world. Our belongings, our house, our car maybe, our friends, certainly our family, maybe where we have some of the strongest attachments. So just a little bit of reflection on the impermanence there tells you, wait, maybe I should be careful with this attachment. Maybe I should be a little bit more cool in my relationship with the world so as not to induce so much suffering for myself in the future. I will talk a bit more about this later on. So why is it that the suffering comes from impermanence? How is it that whatever is impermanent induces suffering in human beings? Not only in human beings, in animals, in the spirits or other realms, whatever it is, we all experience suffering as a consequence of impermanence. Why is that? And the reason is it all starts off with a simple fact that as beings, whatever beings it is, we feel. The Buddha said himself, I teach this teaching to beings that feel, that experience feelings. In other words, it is a specially taught doctrine which has to do with this experience of feeling. Now, once there is feeling, it means that we have two types of feeling. We have pleasant feeling and we have unpleasant feeling. By feeling, I'm not talking about emotions. I'm not talking about a very broad thing. I'm talking about the very most basic sense that we have feelings. There is pleasant feeling and there is unpleasant feeling. And all of our experience can be divided and categorized into pleasant or unpleasant. Whatever it is that we see, whatever it is that we hear, we taste, we smell, we touch, or think, all of these things, our entire experience can be categorized in this way. So, this is the essence of being a being, if you like, is that we feel. And this is the foundation for why we suffer. Because we feel, because we have these two types of experience, pleasant and unpleasant, we are drawn, of course, to the pleasant experiences, and we are, in a sense, we tend to try to avoid the unpleasant feelings. This is called desire. This is craving. Yeah, we go because we have feelings. Craving comes as a natural consequence of having feelings. So being humans means that we have to crave. There's not much choice, at least until you become fully enlightened. And because you have this craving for pleasure and you have this repulsion from pain, it means that we tend to try to search out ways, strategies. We tend to grasp onto things, involve ourselves with things, cling onto things that produce pleasure in our lives. And these strategies that we try to find are things like having a family, having close friends, building a nice house for ourselves, having viewpoints about the world, being a Buddhist, because you think being a Buddhist is going to bring you happiness. All of these things that we hold on to in the world, that we grasp onto, these strategies that we have, they're all about trying to satisfy that craving for happiness. So once we feel there is desire, once we have desire, we get this holding on to things, strategies, attachments, delighting in the world around us. Now, once you start attaching, you start grasping onto things, holding on to things, delighting in the world around you, what happens? Well, what we are delighting in is something which is there at this moment. Before you can think twice, this thing has changed. It's become something else. And this is the law of impermanence. Impermanence always changes whatever it is that we delight in, that we attach to, that we grasp onto, whether it's views, whatever it is, it changes things. And of course, because we delight, because we're attached, when it changes, it feels like something is being pulled away from us that gives us happiness. And that is suffering. So the very nature of being a human being means that you have to suffer. There's no way around it. You have to suffer, and this is only one way. There's many more ways that we have to suffer, but it is one consequence, the consequence of impermanence. Always there's going to be suffering when we delight, when we attach to things in the world. And of course, sometimes it can be a tragic because we have family relations, we have a wife or a husband, that's maybe often where the strongest attachments are, particularly if we have a good relationship. If we have a bad relationship, it doesn't matter so much. Then if the other person dies or whatever, we don't suffer so much. But of course, we had a bad relationship in the first place. There wasn't all that much happiness there. But the sad thing is, if we have a good relationship, really beautiful, wonderful relationship, then often that is also when the suffering is the strongest, because the attachment becomes so powerful. So it's like a lose-lose situation in a sense. And this is the kind of suffering that we have to expect. So just reflecting on that much, just thinking about that, means that you start already at that point to turn your mind away a little bit from attachments, from this delighting in things, and towards finding happiness somewhere else instead, somewhere which is not touched by impermanence in the same way. So that is why we suffer due to impermanence. And that is the kind of a very fundamental, very basic teaching of the Buddha. Another area where the law of impermanence is very is also valid, and which maybe you haven't thought about before, and this is in the area of all the structures that we build up in society. All the, like for example, the way we organize our government, the way we organize our health service, the way we organize our legal service, the way we organize our educational system, all these systems are also impermanent. They cannot last. All these philosophies we have about how to govern, how to do things, all of these things change gradually until eventually they cease completely. And what does that mean in practice? And this has some very powerful consequences, in my opinion. Take all those political systems that arose in the world in the 19th and 20th century, particularly things like communism. Now, communism is a kind of utopian society. You try to set up something, and once it is established, this is the way society is supposed to be organized forever after, and everybody is supposed to be happy in this kind of society. And I think in the communist idea, the Marxist idea, there's also this idea that you can perfect human beings. And from a Buddhist point of view, it's impossible to perfect human beings. Of course, you can become an arahat, full enlightened, and that is a kind of perfection. But the type of perfection that the Marxist had in mind was a very different type of perfection. And you cannot perfect human beings through a political system like that. And it shows the delusion that is involved in these kind of political utopian systems, because there cannot be a utopia. It's impossible because of the law of impermanence. Things are always going to change. The system itself is going to be undermined from within, from without, because of human desires and greed and anger and competition, and from all other kind of forces. Any kind of political system is going to be undermined. So this idea of having a utopian system, whether it's communism, socialism, or even capitalism, anything is never going to be a utopia. It's never going to be something which can last forever after. So this human search for a kind of final solution in things is impossible. There is no final solution. There is no way of establishing a system which is always going to work. And this is also very interesting when we read in the newspapers, you read sometimes about, I sometimes read newspapers myself, and you read, for example, about the health system in WA, and people are complaining it doesn't work properly, people have to queue up, there's not enough room in the intensive care units, and people have to wait for hours to get treatment that they need straight away. We read about all these problems, then people want to blame somebody, they want to say, it's the government's fault, or the doctor's fault, or whoever's fault. But from a Buddhist point of view, that is the wrong way of looking at it. These things are impermanent by their very nature. The health system can never be completely satisfactory. And as soon as you have a system which works well, as soon as you have that, it starts to deteriorate again. It goes down because the law of impermanence comes in and starts pulling it apart, pulling it down, wrecking the beautiful thing that we have built up. And this is not about blaming anybody. There's no point in saying this person is at fault, that person is at fault. Maybe there are people who are at fault. But even if nobody is at fault, it will still collapse. It will still break down. It will still eventually deteriorate to the point where it doesn't work properly anymore. So the correct solution, the correct way, the Buddhist way of looking at the health system, for example, is instead of blaming people, instead of saying that it is trying to find somebody's fault, is to instead look at why is it that it doesn't work anymore? Where is it going wrong? And then try to fix up the problem. That is the right attitude. But don't have any hope that you are going to fix it up forever. Because as soon as it's fixed up, it's going to start deteriorating again. It's going to go down again. And it's an endless thing. Correcting the world, correcting society, correcting the health system, the educational system, the government, the whatever it is, all the systems in the world, there's an endless kind of putting on band-aids forever, fixing it up forever. It can never, never stop. We always have to react to this problem of impermanence around us. And after a while, it gets a bit wearying. After a while, we think, maybe we should be doing something else with our lives. Maybe we can help on the side to keep the system working, because obviously it's good karma to help out to make things work well. But because there is no final solution to samsara, to our society, to make it work correctly, because there is no final solution, if we want to find a final solution, we have to look for it somewhere else. We have to look for it in a spiritual life rather than in the world. And it is one of those things which I often think about. Sometimes in our monastery we have very young people coming to want to become monks. And sometimes, as we know, and I was the same myself when I was much younger, young people are very idealistic. They have this idea in your late teens and early 20s that you want to change the world for the better. The world is not good enough, it's unfair, it's unreasonable, and all that is probably true. To some extent at least, but there is a lot of unfairness in the world. So it's wonderful, it's beautiful to have this, all these young people having all this kind of wanting the world to be a better place. It's a wonderful thing that we have this in ourselves. I mean, many, many people have that. But the idea that we are going to make the world a better place is a false idea. It cannot be made a better place. We can maybe make it temporarily better. Maybe we can do something a little bit to help here and there, alleviate some of the suffering. But usually the idea is that we can have some kind of long-lasting influence on the world, create better systems, create a world which works better than it does now. And that is where the delusion is. Ultimately, there is no system which is perfect. Everything is going to collapse. So sometimes I've had arguments with some of these young people. I told them, you can go out and help the world, but ultimately you're going to be frustrated because you're always going to be patching up systems which fall apart, which don't really work. Instead, you're much better off staying in a monastery here, becoming a monk and doing some real change for this world, something much more profound that really can be of assistance to yourself and to everybody else, and which does have an end in sight. That end, of course, is the ultimately becoming fully enlightened. So that is looking at the world in a different way, taking away some of that desire to always change the world, make the world a better place, because there are such great limitations on how much better the world can actually ever become. So those are two aspects of impermanence. And the third aspect of impermanence that I want to talk about this evening, that is the aspect of impermanence in the mind. And this is maybe the most profound of all the ways of impermanence, because the mind is a very refined and very subtle thing, and there are aspects in the mind such as consciousness. It is very, very difficult to understand how consciousness or the will in human beings can be an impermanent thing. I'm not going to talk about that, because this is really the sort of thing that you may be interested in hearing if you go on a long meditation retreat and you have some deep, profound meditation, and then you can ask a competent teacher, well, how do I contemplate the mind as impermanent? But what I'm going to talk about instead is the impermanence of our ideas, the ideas that we have in our minds. One particular idea, of course, are political ideas. We have the idea that this political party is the right one, this political view is right, this other one is wrong here. And other people have the opposite view, and then we end up in arguments because we disagree on the political things. I think it's probably one of the things that one can very, very easily end up in arguments with is political matters, because people often have very strong views and very different views about these things. But again, look at the impermanence of your own views. Understand how your own views change all the time. There is no permanence in these views. And of course, we all know how, again, when we are young, very often people tend to be more left-leaning. They want to help the world, improve things. They want to have more equality. They want everything to be fair and right. So tend to be more on the left side of politics. And then, of course, and this, I think, is a very well-known thing which has been researched quite extensively, as people get older, they become more conservative. They want to preserve the way the world is, because now they have become part of the establishment. They've become part, they have enough money. Now they want to conserve what they have, rather than actually be radical and change things. And this is how our own political views very often change in life. So look at that. Understand how your views change. Look at other ways your view changes. Look at very simple things like, what do you like around you? What is it that you enjoy in your life? What are the things that please you in life? And these things also change as you get older. What kind of food do you like? The food you liked as a child is very different from the food you often like as an adult. And this, in a sense, is a kind of view, because often you go out arguing about these things, talking to your friends, saying, oh, this food is very nice, but this is not so nice. And your friend might say the opposite. The color of your curtains in your living room, that's another area I'm sure that views can change, and views vary a lot. We can argue about this thing endlessly here, about what to have. So look at those views. Understand how impermanent they are. Understand how they change everything that you believe in, everything you think of. Even your view of Buddhism, I'm sure it has changed enormously over the years. Certainly mine has. It is very different now from what it was, say, 15 years ago. And I think, I hope so, I hope I'm getting closer to the truth as I'm getting older. But the point is, these things are impermanent. And when you remember that these things are impermanent, when you meet somebody with a different viewpoint from your viewpoint, don't become upset, don't become angry. Remind yourself of the impermanence of these things. Maybe you're right, Maybe you're wrong, yeah? But this is nothing to argue about. Maybe you will view things the same way as the other person in a few years' time. Maybe the other person will change their mind and view things the way you do. But if you know the impermanence of these things, you can reduce so much disputes and arguments about things which in reality, at the end of the day, there often is no solution to these arguments anyway. So try this and see if that helps in your life to have a more peaceful existence. You don't have to argue about so many things because these things ultimately are uncertain. We don't know. It's just all very often, it's just a different way of looking at the same thing. And sometimes both ways may be valid in their own right. So that is a few ways of looking at impermanence, what is encompassed by this idea we call impermanence in Buddhism. Now, for a couple of examples of how to use this in our lives, a slightly more practical examples maybe here. And one thing that I thought might be useful to mention is this economic crisis that we have been going through in the world for over the last few months. How do we look at that from a Buddhist point of view? What is the right attitude to these kind of things? The first thing is to understand, as I said before, the financial system of the world is just another system. And because it is another system, it is going to be impermanent. It's going to change. It is never going to be something which is absolutely steady, which is always going to be going right, always be going the way you like it. That is impossible. So that is the first thing you should reflect. And once you have that thought in mind, once you understand that all these systems, including particularly the financial system, is impermanent, it's unstable, it's always being undermined by forces in the world, forces like greed perhaps, anger, all these forces in the human mind which tend to distort things and make things different. Once you think, reflect in that way, you realize, of course, it is going down the drain. Of course, we're having a crisis in the world. What do you expect? This is the way things are. There has to be impermanence. There has to be change. It's always going to be this way. And if you reflect like that, when a crisis comes next time, you shrug your shoulders and you say, oh, of course there is a crisis going out there. This is part of life. This is the nature of things, that there has to be crises every now and again. And of course, this is one of the beautiful advantages of being a Buddhist or having an interest in Buddhism, is that we have this understanding already beforehand that these things are impermanent. So they don't come to us as a shock, as it might do to somebody who has an idea that, for example, the world was created by a creating force. Now, if some force created this world, then there is a good reason maybe to ask why the financial system does collapse, because there doesn't seem to be any point to it anymore. But in Buddhism, when everything is just impermanent, everything is conditioned by other phenomena, everything is an eternal flux, this is to be expected. This has to happen. It's not very strange that things should collapse in this way. And the more you keep reflecting in this way, the more you keep reminding yourself, contemplating this thing we call impermanence, the less surprised you are going to be next time it happens. The more you're going to say, of course it's happening. Of course this is the way it has to be. This is the way the world is. And then you can do whatever needs to be done to make sure you don't get hurt so badly next time it happens. So just the reflection, just the reminding yourself maybe every day that things are impermanent, and just remind yourself of which things are impermanent, your belongings, your friends, your family, the financial system, the governmental system, the ideologies we follow, everything. The more you remind yourself of that, and the more you contemplate that in a deep way, the more you're going to let go, and the more you're going to step back and just allow things to happen according to the nature without holding on too much. So it is a very powerful and very good way of reflecting here. Now the other thing I wanted to mention and discuss, which is a very, maybe even more practical way of looking at impermanence, and that is a story from taken from the suttas, which I wanted to recount very briefly. And this is a story found in the Majjhima Nikaya. And this is a story with the king of a kingdom of ancient India called Kosala. The king of Kosala was called King Pasenadeha. This kingdom was a very large kingdom at the time of the Buddha. There was two large kingdoms. There was Kosala and there was Magadha, and they were vying for supremacy at that time in India. And this king, Pasenadeha, the king of Kosala, he had a queen called Queen Malika. And this queen, she was a very staunch supporter of the Buddha. She had very powerful faith in the Buddha. So, at some stage, a story came into the palace, and the king and the queen got to hear about this story. And this story was about a man whose son had died, and because his son had died, he was very, very distraught. He was feeling absolutely terrible. He was literally going out of his mind because of his attachment to this son. He was wandering around trying to find advice everywhere, couldn't really find anybody who could give advice. Ended up going to the Buddha and said to the Buddha, "Where is my son? What is happening? What is going on? My son is dead. What should I do? This is unbearable. I don't know what to do with myself." And the Buddha answered, a very simple answer. He said that people who are dear to you, they are a cause for suffering. And this man, he wasn't ready to hear that. That is a very, in one way, it's a very simple teaching. It's very straightforward. It's very easy to understand. But also, in many ways, very profound. It's the kind of teaching people usually don't want to hear. People who are dear to you are a cause for suffering in your life. And this man, he was not ready to hear this. He became upset. And he stormed off. And he went to other people and said, "This ascetic is saying that people who are dear to you are a cause for suffering. What do you think?" "Oh, we think that people who are dear to you, they are a cause for happiness," everybody else said. Because that is the view of the world. That was the view of the world then. That is the view of the world now. People who are dear to you, they are a cause for happiness in your life. And of course, everybody tended to agree with this poor man. And nobody really understood what the Buddha had said. So this story then eventually comes to the palace. And King Pasenadeha and Queen Malika, they get to hear this story. And when Queen Malika hears the story, straight away she says, "Well, if that is what the Buddha says, it must be true." And the king gets upset and he said, "Ah, whatever that Samana says, whatever that Buddha says, you always say it's true, whatever he says. Off with you, Malika. I don't want to see you again." So he was not very happy with the queen always siding with the Buddha against himself. So the queen decides, "I'm going to have to test this out. I'm going to send a man to the Buddha and ask him about this and see what the Buddha has to say." So she sends a man to the Buddha, and this man says to the Buddha, whatever dear people you have in your life, they are a cause for suffering. And the Buddha says, "So it is, so it is." And then, of course, he gives the examples and he says, "Well, what happens if your wife were to become very ill or even die? How would you feel?" "I would feel terrible. I would go out of my mind. I would feel absolutely bad because my wife is so dear to me." "How would you feel if your children were suddenly to die at a young age when they hadn't really fulfilled their life's potential yet, or they got very, very severely sick? How would you feel about that?" "I would feel terrible again, absolutely awful, because my children are so dear to me." And in this way, he went on talking about the various kinds of relatives and friends. And always, this person had to admit, it is suffering that arises when people who are close to you fall sick in a severe way, or eventually they die. So this man then went back to the palace, told the queen about this, and the queen then went to the king and told him what the Buddha had said. And she put it in a slightly different way. She said, "How would you feel, King Pasenadeha, how would you feel if your son, Vidudaba, I think his name is, if he were to die? I would grieve, I would feel terrible. He is supposed to take over this kingdom when I pass away. It would be a terrible thing if he were to pass away. How would you feel if I were to die? I am your wife, the queen. Again, I would feel absolutely terrible. You are my favorite wife. It would be an awful thing if you passed away. How would you feel if the country you are ruling, Kosala, if that were to go to ruin and disappear? Again, I would feel terrible because I love this country. I love the people. I love this land. It would be a terrible thing if this happened. And then Queen Malika says to the king, this is what the Buddha meant when he said that suffering arises from people who are dear to you. And then the king understood, the Buddha is right. The Buddha made a very important point. And from then on, he became a much more staunch follower of the Buddha. Before that, he was skeptical. Now he started to become a staunch follower of the Buddha himself. And King Pasenadi eventually became one of the very strong supporters of the Buddha until he died at 80 years old, much later on. So this is it's a simple story, but boy, it is also very profound, because it's so hard not to attach to the people who are close to us. In fact, it is probably impossible not to attach at all. But just reflecting on a story like that, we can weaken the attachments at least a little bit. We can turn our mind in a different direction, try to find more happiness somewhere else. Find happiness in the spiritual practice, find an inner happiness in doing good, by being kind and compassionate in the world, by being peaceful and tranquil, by doing a bit more meditation. And by changing our priorities a little bit, away from the material world of bodies and people, towards the spiritual side, we can create something which is much more untouchable inside of us. Something much more stable, something much more invulnerable, which is more apart from the world around us. And that is what we should do when we see this kind of thing. And maybe you think that if I become less attached to my family, to my friends, maybe I won't be such a good parent anymore. Maybe I won't be such a good wife or husband if I do that. But that actually the opposite is true. The exact opposite is the reality. If you become more detached, if you have less desire, less anger, less of these things that we connect with attachment in our life, the more clear your mind is going to be, the more clear it is going to be to you how you should act with the people around you, how you can help them in a good way, how you can do things which supports them in the right way. The less attachment you have, the more clear your mind is, and the better you're going to be as a husband, the better you're going to be as a wife, as a parent, as a child, as a grandmother, as a grandfather, as a friend, as an uncle, as an aunt, as a nephew, etc., etc., etc. You become more skilled because you have more wisdom, basically, when you have less attachment. Your view of the world is not so distorted anymore by your desires and by any aversion and other things that may come up because of those attachments. But ultimately, the more you reflect on impermanence overall, the more you think about this, that everything is always changing, everything is always unstable, nothing can really hold up, you always have to patch things up to keep things going. Ultimately, all relationships, particularly the good ones, they always end in suffering. There may be a lot of happiness there on the way, but the end point is always suffering. It always ends that way. And that is what is, of course, so dismal about it, that it has to end in that way. The more we reflect like that, the more you can start to channel more of your energy into the spiritual path instead. Just slightly changing your priorities, moving away from that. And ultimately, you might come to the point where you might want to give up the world entirely and become a monk or a nun. And that is, of course, one of the wonderful things that we have here in Western Australia. We have this possibility of becoming a monk and a nun in a monastery somewhere. And get away from this impermanence, get away from this suffering once and for all, and try to make an end of it. Give that 100% of your priority, because ultimately, from the Buddhist point of view, it is really the only way out of this mess that we are in this samsara. So, enough. Okay, so do you have any questions, any comments, anything you want to say here about tonight's talk? Over there, yes, sir. Sorry. Okay. Yeah, that was something I was going to talk about. I forgot about that altogether here. I was going to talk a little bit about, is there anything in the world which is permanent? Is absolutely everything permanent? Or are there actually things which are permanent? And from a Buddhist point of view, there are actually things which are permanent. And one of those things is that enlightenment itself is permanent in the sense that once you destroy the defilements of the mind, they can never arise again. So in that sense, it is permanent. Once that has been eliminated, it can't come back again. So yes, there is certainly a permanent aspect to enlightenment. But of course, an enlightened being in himself, that being is not permanent, because eventually, even if you're enlightened, you're going to have to die, pass away. That side of impermanence is still there. But the actual realization is true, is permanent. Once you have it forever. But the other thing which is interesting there is, well, are there anything at all? Is there anything at all in the world which actually is permanent? And from the Buddhist point of view, the one thing which is permanent, and it is a slightly, it's like a different order, if you like, from the tangible things in the world, the things we see around us, the things which are immediately here. And the things which are permanent from the Buddhist point of view are the laws of Buddhism, the laws which describe how the world works. And that, of course, includes impermanence itself. Impermanence, in a sense, is permanent, in the sense that it doesn't change. There will always be impermanence there. And the same thing with suffering, the same thing with non-self. These are descriptions of how the world works, and they will always be like that. Or things like this deep philosophical doctrine that we have in Buddhism called dependent origination. The Buddha said specifically, this is a stability, because this is how the world works. So the descriptions of the world, the way that describe how the world works, they are permanent. But the actual content of the world, that's impermanent. So again, there's a slight difference there. Anybody else has any questions, sir? You're more than welcome to ask simple over there. Yes, sir. Why we have to live in this world? Why it is like that? Okay. Yeah, it's very unfortunate, isn't it? Yeah. No, I think the problem is that it's the kind of question that the Buddha didn't really answer. The Buddha wasn't interested in the why. He was interested in basically, this is the mess we're in. What can we do about it? And so he doesn't really say why the world is the way it is. But what you can say, just generally speaking, is that one of the basic Buddhist principles, the principle of karma, that you get what you sow. If you sow bad actions, you get bad things in return. You get suffering in return. If you do good things, you get happiness and good things in return. So in a sense, the reason why the world is the way it is because we have done a fair amount of bad karma in the past. So we're now reaping the results, and those results are going to be painful. That is one answer to that question, why the world is the way it is. But I think if you try to go deeper than that, I don't think there really is any ultimate answer to the question why the world is the way it is. It just is this way. There is a problem. This is the way it is. And the famous simile of the Buddha, which he used in the suttas, in his discourses, the simile of a man who is shot by a poisoned arrow. Do you know that simile? And the man starts asking, well, you know, who made this arrow? What is this material? What is the shaft made of? What is the tip made of? Is the man who shot it, what caste is he from? Is he tall, small, fat, short, all these things? And of course, what he should concentrate on instead is getting the arrow pulled out. Because he will die unless he gets the arrow pulled out. And this idea, question of why the world is the way it is, I think ultimately is that kind of question. It's the kind of question that you probably never find a satisfactory answer to. So you just have to get on with the task of getting out of the problem as it actually stands. Happy with that? Yeah? Okay, good. Yeah. Yeah.